Welcome to the conversation. Thanks for joining us. The National Education Association wrapped up its annual conference this week with a policy statement on charter schools. In it, the organization criticizes largely unaccountable privately managed chartered schools. The NEA continues its support of public charter schools, though with the caveat that a charter school should be authorized, quote, only if the charter is both necessary to meet the needs of students in the district and will meet those needs in a manner that improves the local public school system. Hawaii State Teachers Association President Corey Rosenly attended the NEA conference, and he joins us now by phone. Hi there. Corey?
Can you hear me?
Now we can. Good to talk to you, and thanks for joining us. The NEA called unaccountable charter schools a failed and damaging experiment. How do they define unaccountable?
Well, what you have right now across the mainland is you have a lot of charter schools that have just come in and started taking away money from the public education system. And now we have things such as private, for-profit charter schools. These are charter schools set up by for-profit companies that are just trying to make a profit off of public education without, you know, doing a good job.
And how is it that they're able to get public school money to be able to do that?
Well, that's the whole thing of the charter school system. You know, and we have a different system here in Hawaii. Our charter school teachers have to be held up to the same standards. They're accountable. They're all members of the union. But on the mainland, you have companies that set up a charter school, get money from the public school system. And one of the first things they try to do is they try to get teachers out of the union. They lower wages. They do not provide the same services. And what has happened is that these for-profit charter schools are not doing a very good job. And you've seen with the whole Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, she doesn't want to shut these down. She wants to actually encourage more of these. And that's only leading to segregation in our public schools.
And I want to get to that in just a second, but as we look at this whole charter school movement, and sometimes we talk about it in a way as if it's coalesced and that it's the same across the nation, and this really seems to illustrate the point that it's not.
Well, you have a place like New Orleans right now where they have basically gotten rid of all of the public schools and done all charter schools. You have a situation in Los Angeles right now where, you know, they're just dramatically increasing the amount of charter schools. And what happens oftentimes in these areas is, first of all, the first group that usually goes to charter schools are parents trying to motivate them to take their kids out. And what occurs then is there is the segregation that occurs. Students that are unable to leave or maybe have higher needs, such as special education students, are unable to leave, and they're left in the public school system as others move out. And that leads to, you know, again, a segregated school system. And then what's left in the public schools are usually the more expensive students. And that is oftentimes creates a lot of problems and makes it, it means that the public schools have to provide less programs because they just don't have the money, and it's even harder to provide the basic services for those students that remain.
You made the point a moment ago that Hawaii's charter schools are very different. In any way, does the NEA's view on charters in general color how the schools in Hawaii may be viewed?
One of the things when considering the new policy that NEA has on charter schools was we looked at Hawaii and we asked, okay, are we doing these things? And for the most part, we are. They have to take all students. In fact, special education students that go to charter schools, that's actually the public school system, the DOE, actually provides the teachers for that. So we make sure that those needs are met. They have the same wages. They have the same contract. They are the same accountability system. So, you know, charter schools, the idea was set up to be, you know, be creative, be innovation, areas where these new programs can be tried out. But one of the things that we've been consistently advocating for is, you know, why not allow the public schools to do the same things? You know, being able to try out new ways of curriculum and trying out new strategies shouldn't be just confined to charter schools. Give that same freedom to public schools and principals and teachers that want to take their schools and try to, you know, find innovative ways of getting to their students. And that's been sort of the problem, is we've just said only some schools are allowed to be innovative, and that's not effective.
Is this, in a way, setting up Hawaii to potentially show a model to the rest of the country?
Well, Hawaii is unique, but we have to make sure that one of the frustrating parts for all teachers is sometimes we believe that charter schools are the only ones that can be innovative and creative for education. There are some amazing things being done in our public schools, and oftentimes some of the public school teachers have, you know, shared with me, you know, take for example, we have some of our charter schools that are able to do something called performance assessment portfolios, authentic assessments. And these are getting away from standardized testing and using project-based learning. And we've seen the effectiveness of this. And so why is it that is confined to a charter school and not allowed for the public schools? We should be taking the best ideas, whether they're from charter or public, and putting them into our schools instead of it being that there's only charters or only public. That's not effective for our children.
Bringing those ideas into public schools seemed to be the whole point of, for example, all the, you know, the high-tech, high-type schools
exactly.
that we've been seeing over many years now. Is that some way being thwarted by some of these unaccountable charter schools on the mainland?
Well, high-tech high is a great example of what our schools should be. It's a project-based learning environment, and kids thrive in that environment. And for our public schools, we've been fighting for years to try to get rid of the test is everything. Unfortunately, on the mainland, that's exactly what's occurring. In order to justify these private schools, they become basically test factories. And all they do is try to get these bubble test higher scores to justify more of these private schools, while oftentimes, you know, neglecting some students and not allowing some students to attend and not teaching to the, you know, whole child. And what has shown is that when this occurs in communities, instead of improving education, it makes it worse. You know, it's been a failed experiment, and that's why, you know, the National Education Association took a hard stance this week in saying this has to stop. It's not good for our children.
It seems that also means that you took a hard stance against the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos.
Well, Betsy DeVos is, instead of looking at the research, she has been promoting vouchers. I mean, vouchers are just a horrible way of educating every child. A great experiment was done in Norway and Finland. Finland tried the approach of educating every child. Norway tried a competitive model like Betsy DeVos has been proposing. And what happened in Norway is that everyone tried to get these higher test scores, and so basically they started to lie on them. And even though they have, you know, free college and free health care and free daycare, both of them have that, Finland is in the top of the world, Norway is not. And what Finland does differently is they say, no, we're not going to have a competitive model. Our belief is in equity, that every child, regardless of what community they live in, should have a quality education. And that's what research shows works, and that's why Betsy DeVos's model is, you know, bad for communities and bad for children.
So at this point, with the idea that you never know from where brilliance may come and every child deserves a good education, what do you think this means for Hawaii? What do you take back from this as you're soon to be back on our shores?
Well, you know, we've got to continue to keep up the fight. There are many attacks going on public education, whether it's these privatized charter schools, whether it's vouchers, whether it's high-stakes testing. You know, I encourage everyone to look at the research and see what works for children, and that's what we have to do. And that's what, you know, the National Education Association and the Hawaii State Teachers Association is trying to do. We're out there advocating for our keiki to make sure they have the schools that they deserve.
In all of that advocacy, though, Corey, what specifically do you think that you might be able to do in this next year before you all meet again and have the next annual convention?
Well, you know, we're trying to make sure things such as this. We want to move away from high-stakes testing to what research shows works better, which is authentic assessments. we've got to make sure that we keep and recruit and retain teachers, because right now we have thousands of kids every day that go to school and don't have a qualified teacher in the classroom. You know, we've got to make sure that if we do have charter schools in Hawaii, that they are just as accountable, just as transparent as all of our public schools. I think there are many areas in that which not just teachers, but the whole community has to continuously advocate that we make sure that we have good public schools, and this is the key part, for all children.
We're going to leave it there. Thanks very much, and safe journey home.
Thank you.
Corey Rosenlee is president of the Hawaii State Teachers Association. It's the union representing 13,500 public school teachers across the state of Hawaii. He taught high school social studies for more than 20 years in Hawaii.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up in the show, artists ask themselves what the far-off future will look like. But first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're feeling nostalgic about a favorite childhood TV show. If you watched it, you know it, and you probably loved it. It was routine for the children of Hawaii. Every day after school, Keiki would run home and tune into the two-hour adventure at 3 o'clock. The show ran Monday to Friday on KGMB, and Keiki would watch and pray that one day they'd appear on the interactive live show. The lucky ones who attended were able to get picked from the audience to participate in pulling as many pennies from a jar with one hand and keeping them. The games and the gags became an escape for kids as they laughed along to pie throwing and sing-along songs. Simple fun. They wouldn't miss seeing Mr. Checkers in his go-go glasses and Pogo Pogue in his tiny red hat. Now, the show ran from 1967 to 1982, and over the years, the show went through three Mr. Checkers. So our question for you today is, who was the longest-running person to play Mr. Checkers on the show? And in what year did he begin? If you know those answers, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And the first one to get it right gets our reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Aloha, I'm Kanila, Danny Kalikini.
And I'm Nicholas Kalikini.
And you're listening to The Conversation on Members-Supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Hawaii's artists in the year 2017 have been invited to find ways to portray what Hawaii will be like 1,000 years from now, and to consider the ways contact between the islands and the outside world will change it. More than a dozen local artists will be displaying their work this month in a downtown Honolulu show called Contact 3017. Nane Alum is one of those asked to share their view of Hawaii's future, and she's with us in our studio. Hi, Nanea. Thanks for coming in.
Hi, thanks for having me.
When you first were presented with this idea, use your art to envision a world 1,000 years from now, what were your reactions?
1,000 years in the future is way past when I'll be around or anyone that I know will be around.
Quite likely.
It was one of those ideas that really threw people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, what am I going to make? My work isn't really about that.
Sure.
But I think contact as a theme for that far in the future means to use what you know now.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you, and one of the references to thinking about the future is, of course, the past, right?
Yeah. My entryway into Contact 3017 was looking at my systems of time through my culture, Hawaiian culture. Hawaiians were thinking about the future through looking at the past and thinking about sustainability in the present.
Mm-hmm.
And our creation stories, our Kumulipo, that was my entry point into mm-hmm. The future.
How so?
So Papahanao Moku is the story of the earth goddess giving birth to the islands. Mm-hmm. And that's a truth that goes from the past to the future to the present and has a working way into all of our crafts, all of our ways that we maintain the aina.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the future, you're doing all of that now, but it's for the people that come after you.
Well, you know, taking the notion of contact and looking 1,000 years in the past, there was very little contact between the Hawaiian Islands and anywhere outside, right?
Yeah. I mean, the first, so Contact is an annual show. There's been four Contact shows before this one.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the very first shows, the theme was contact, like in the beginning, the first contact with the Western world. And you're asked to give your response to that, being from here or being someone who's lived here a long time. There was a lot of response.
a lot of response with regard to the whole idea of that first contact.
Contact. People from that have a native perspective will say that the first contact is representative of knowledge being taken or knowledge being given mm-hmm. to our islands. And I think what I offer in response to that every year at Contact is using my indigenous knowledge and being young and also born and raised here.
Mm-hmm. In your work, you use an actual, you know, very recognizable representation of a human body.
Yeah.
Derived from a photograph, is that right?
I take my own resource photos and I have my own process of how I start an mm-hmm. oil painting. And my oil paintings, they're really looking at the body and they're looking at the landscape and how everything is interconnected. And that's exactly what the creation story of Papahanao Moku really is about.
Mm-hmm.
Everything being interconnected through time, but also through materiality. And that's my specialty with oils is the viscosity of paint, color interrelation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that it's kind of superimposed over a very recognizable image of a human body, right?
Yeah. We were looking at a photo, or I took a photo of a woman's figure under the water. Her head is above water.
Mm-hmm.
And that kind of brings the image of an island where a lot of the bedrock is underneath the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And the head is above water, all of that. Thinking and feeling and maybe stuff that happens with interrelation of contact, but there's still that Papahanao Moku that's beneath the sea that is ever there and never changing too.
We tend not to think of islands or atolls as the tips of undersea mountains. We tend to think of them almost as if they were floating on the ocean surface, but most of them is underwater.
Yeah.
Which is a whole kind of, that whole inspires quite a number of reflections on your part, it seems.
Yep. Contact, there was a lot of mediums that responded to that idea of the island, is it going to sink? Is it going to not be here at all? And that's really the beauty of Contact being an annual show is every year you get work from artists that work in all different medias.
And like any good arts presentation, it invites you to think, doesn't it, Nanea?
Yeah, it does.
Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Nanea Lom is one of 12 artists taking part in Selections from Contact 3017, an exhibit at Mark's Garage in downtown Honolulu, and there's an opening reception for the show tonight at 6 p.m. You can find out more on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Rest of the rail money will come from still doesn't have an answer. Of the possible ways to bridge the shortfall of the over-budget project, taxes in one form or another are the options that got heated debate at a recent Honolulu City Council meeting. Civil Beat reporter Stuart Yurton breaks it down in today's Reality Check. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Beth Ann.
We've talked a lot over many, many years about the idea of tax fairness, and that seems to be squarely at the heart of all of the options that are being floated to be able to bridge that gap. Are some more fair than others?
Yes. According to the experts that we spoke to, we really look at two main taxes at the county level, and we can discuss the fairness of those. One is the general excise tax, which taxes pretty much every transaction with a number of exemptions, but really every transaction that occurs in the economy. And the idea is that this tax is really regressive. What does that mean? It means that it places a greater burden on lower income people because they spend more on essentials than wealthier or higher income people.
And that it has been sort of the big angst that we've been feeling around the GET and the idea of either extending it or inflating it.
Yes. Well, the idea is to extend a half a percentage point charge, they call it a surcharge, on the general excise tax for Oahu for 10 years. This would raise an enormous amount of money, about $2.6 billion over those 10 years at the current rate that that's producing right now. But again, the question is how does that impact lower income people versus others?
At the conclusion of the last session, we really didn't have any more answers to any of these questions about how we were going to be able to get that shortfall. And then there came the sort of the 11th hour surprise of let's just inflate the TAT. How is that going over?
Well, as you probably recall, that did not go over very well. The idea is that already the transient accommodation tax or the hotel room tax is really high, especially when you add the general excise tax here, and going higher to I think around 16% combined is what they were talking about would at some point start affecting visitors and the economy.
So I mean we're kind of back to the same argument. On whose backs are we going to be able to make up this shortfall? Are we talking about bringing it in from more tourists and potentially driving them away, as you've just talked about? Or are we going to simply hide it in something that would be in the surcharge for the GET? Is there anything in the middle?
Well, the other idea that's been talked about, but that is also unpopular among certain people, is a property tax. And that can still be regressive, but the experts we spoke to for the story today said it is generally less regressive than the general excise tax.
And might be more transparent. Okay, for the moment, we're going to leave it there. We're going to talk with Tom Yamachika a little later, but thanks very much.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Stuart Yurton joined us from civilbeat.org with today's Reality Check. It's a Friday, and one of the things that we usually do but haven't done for a couple of weeks now is to take a look at what's going on in our news department that we'll all be hearing next week. The reason for that is that Bill Dorman has been away. So welcome back, and what great things are we going to hear from our news department. Something going on the Big Island, I understand.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Yes, absolutely. You know, always something interesting going on in the Big Island. But one growing business over there, film and video production. A lot of times when people talk about film and video production here in Hawaii, the emphasis is on Oahu, you know, as recently as this morning. If you're driving by the Halona Blowhole and Jurassic Park filming there, Hawaii Five-O, of course. Boy, we'll sorely miss Daniel Day Kim and Grace Park, by the way. But on the Big Island, this is growing. Over the past year, more than 50 productions, varying in size, of course, but County Film Commissioner Justin Feinstone says they've spent about $3.5 million on Hawaii Island over the past year. And a lot of stories behind that, of course, spending a lot more around the state. But Sherry Bracken spoke with Justin, and she's going to have some tales from that conversation, and we'll hear from Justin more next week.
That sounds good. What about a different take on an electric vehicle?
You know, lots of developments continuing in the world of electric vehicles. Just this week alone, Tesla said first mass market electric car coming off production lines. Volvo said that within a couple of years, car it produces is going to have, yeah, exactly, some battery power. But how is this for a twist on that? You take a 73 Porsche, good old gas-driven car, turn it into an electric car.
I hope somebody's going to take some good pictures of that one, too.
And see them online for sure. Guy in Kailua did that, and a pretty entertaining story about how he did it, how things went with the Department of Motor Vehicles and a whole train on that. Kuvehi Hiraishi is going to have a lot more about that this coming week.
Meanwhile, we also have a very important deadline looming for the governor.
Yeah, exactly. And it's great you're going to have the governor on live during Town Square next week on Thursday. No visible deadline on that special legislative session that may or may not be coming to talk about rail financing. But the veto deadline is coming, as you know, Tuesday. And that's on items from the last legislative session. And again, Wayne Yoshioka is going to have a recap on the veto front, potential prospects for veto overrides, and sort of set the stage. But it'll be great to have Governor Ige here on Thursday.
And we'll ask him about a lot of that and more as we move through this week, this next coming week.
You
Thanks
bet.
So much. Good to have you back.
Aloha.
HPR's news director, Bill Dorman, joins us every week with a preview of what's being worked on in our news department.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Inter Island Solar Supply, Kaiser Permanente, and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
In October of 2015, the Tax Foundation of Hawaii filed a lawsuit over the constitutionality of the money the state takes from the rail surcharge. The 10% skim the state receives unfairly burdens taxpayers, according to the foundation, and brings in more money than it takes to fund the administration costs. The case made its way to the Hawaii Supreme Court, which heard oral arguments yesterday. Tax Foundation President Tom Yamachika joins us now. This has sort of been a long time coming, and we don't know exactly when we're going to hear the final decision. But just to refresh people's memory a little bit about this, why did you tell them that this was unfairly burdening taxpayers?
Well, the issue that we raised in the lawsuit was that what we have is a surcharge on the GE tax that only burdens the people of Honolulu and businesses in Honolulu. And 10% of that is skimmed off the top, and it goes into the state general fund to do whatever it is, wherever they want it. So it's basically like, under, you know, the way the statute has been interpreted, we in Honolulu pay more for, you know, state goods and services than the residents of other islands.
They,
and you know, to the tune of like $25 million more every year. That's what the skim is, because the surcharge brings in maybe $250 million, so the skim is $25 million.
At the conclusion of last session, we didn't really have any more answers than we frankly have right now as to what was going to happen for the rail and being able to make up the shortfall. But part of the conversation was clearly was this football about the skim. Should it be 1%? Should it be 10%? What happens with it? That seems to be more on the wayside now, as you're just trying to get to some of the basics of whether the skim should be there at all. But the interesting thing about this case is that there's nobody disputing the facts of what the statutes say. This is all going to come down really to interpretation, which makes it properly placed with the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the state was, you know, arguing very desperately that we at the foundation really have no right to bring this to court at all.
They said you had no standing originally.
Right, because they think it's the city's fight. But and the problem, of course, with that was, the city and state made either an agreement or the state told them what to do or whatever it was, you know, some unholy pact. But governments don't pay taxes. Taxpayers pay taxes. So what really wasn't considered in any of this is, you know, how much everybody's wallet is being hit.
At this point, when, you know, the arguments are pretty much staying the same, I'm sure you didn't hear anything different yesterday.
No. We from the questions that the justices were asking, it seems like that they're at least willing to entertain, the possibility of telling, the courts and the state, you know, what the statute really means.
Because if they hadn't been, they would have simply kicked it back and said, no, we're not going to handle this.
That's right.
So at this point, not knowing when we're going to get an answer for this, it's just going to be kind of hanging out there. Did you have any indication at all that, aside from the fact that they obviously were listening to the argument, that we might see some real changes in what happens with the skim?
Well, I certainly hope so. Of course, it's too early to tell exactly what if anything they're going to do with it. But we're, you know, cautiously optimistic that that they'll do something beneficial to the taxpayers.
Meanwhile, we still have this issue with the rail and what's going to happen to be able to bridge that gap. You heard that we talked to Stuart Yurden just a little while ago from Civil Beat, and I know you talked to him too about it as you know, these options, all taxation options, which nobody might like. Is there any mitigating way of being able to judge one over another as you see it?
Well, you know, each has its own share of pluses and minuses. And ultimately, lawmakers are going to determine their fate. But the problem is, if they don't get together and decide on something, then we're going to be stuck with what we now have. Both the House and the Senate versions of the bill last session contained a provision knocking the skim down from 10% to 1%, which we think is a much more palatable alternative, but given that nobody's agreed on the final version, it's going to stay 10% until such time as people do agree.
But that still goes back to the constitutionality issue of it, right? Because whether it's 1% or 10%, you're still dealing with, is this or is this not constitutional?
Well, we never really disputed that, the fact that the state's doing work, i.e. they're collecting this stuff. And so they're entitled to be paid their costs.
But more than their cost was the issue.
Yeah, I mean, we had reports that the state tax department issued saying that their costs were like $1 million a year, if that. Maybe it was a little bit more in the earlier stages because of, startup costs and that kind of thing. But $1 million a year versus $25 million that they're actually collecting is a big difference. And it's a heck of a lot more that's being extracted out of, the Honolulu residents' pockets to do, God knows what. I mean, it isn't even going to the state tax department. It's going into general fund for general use.
But but funding the entire budget is what it's seemingly doing by collecting that amount of money more. So, I mean, is this a way of simply being able to draw money from those of us who will unwittingly just keep paying it?
That's what we contended. I mean, we tried to point out, look, you know, the operational expenses of the Department of Taxation are comparable to what the state's bringing in off this one tax. And by operational expenses, I mean, you know, top to bottom, soup to nuts, to collect
budget.
All their, right. you know, all their taxes, all the systems that are out there, and this real surcharge scheme can pay for all of it, top to bottom. So it's too much. It's way too much.
Well, we're going to see if the Supreme Court agrees with you. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you so
much. Always good to talk to you. Tom Yamachika is the president of the Tax Foundation of Hawaii. It's an educational organization dedicated to informing the public about the finances of state and local governments in Hawaii.
Earlier in the show, we revisited the show Checkers and Pogo, a daily after-school program that boasted a live audience of Island Keiki in the studio. The two-hour show of games and gags was the brainchild of KGMB owner Cecil Heftel and starred the father figure character Mr. Checkers and his carefree sidekick Pogo Pogue. Do you remember seeing the twosome riding around town in the Checkermobile? How about standing in line for the towering sky slide or sitting in front of the set to enjoy the popular on-the-go segment? It was one of the longest-running and most successful shows in Hawaii, and Checkers and Pogo ran from 1967 to 1982. Three actors played the title role of Mr. Checkers, starting with Jim Hawthorne, followed by Dave Donnelly, and finally, Jim Demarest. It was Demarest who, from 1968 to 1979, portrayed Mr. Checkers the longest. Nobody got that today, but thanks to Tara Grusby for inspiring today's quiz. If you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000, welcoming students, parents, teachers, and administrators back to school. Learn more about new product and training updates for Hawaii schools at Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
The idea of extraterrestrial life is no longer the sole province of science fiction. Recent discoveries within our solar system, added to our growing understanding of the sheer vastness of the universe, have changed all that. Dr. Abraham Loeb, chair of the astronomy department at Harvard University, says recent discoveries have shown that there are billions of habitable planets out there.
We learned that not only we have potential for life within the solar system, for example, in the plumes, the geysers that we observed in Enceladus, one of the satellites in the solar system that seems to have liquid water under its surface and potentially life. And we hope to search for that in the coming years, but not only in those nearby environments, but also around other stars. We now know that a substantial fraction of all the stars, somewhere between a tenth and a quarter of all the stars, have an Earth size planet in at the right distance from the star to keep itself roughly at room temperature so that the liquid water may exist on its surface. And the goal of the coming years would be to figure out whether there is life on some of those planets. If we extrapolate to the rest of the universe, we find that there are more habitable planets in the universe than grains of sand in all the beaches on Earth. So if you think about a king or an emperor in the past history of humans that conquered a piece of land and was boasting about it, was very proud of himself, arrogant, that he conquered a large piece of land, it's pretty much similar to an ant that hugs a grain of sand on the background of a huge beach. there is nothing to be proud about. The big picture is so rich that it teaches us modesty. And my basic conclusion is that, you know, not only that we are not at the center of the physical universe, the sun is not moving around the earth, and we are not at the center of the universe, but also we are probably not at the center of the biological universe, the living universe.
Well, doctor, that modesty you speak of has been a long time in coming in the world of science, hasn't it?
Well, it was adapted in the case of the Earth not being at the center of the universe physically, but there are still many scientists that believe that perhaps life is rare or unique to Earth. It's a natural tendency. I mean, I have two young daughters, and when they were infants, they tended to think that everything centers around them. And as they grew up and matured, they got a better perspective and realized that there are other people out there and things are not centered on them. Our civilization is slowly maturing. We realized already that we're not at the center of the physical universe in terms of our location, but it will be in the next decade or so that my expectation that we will figure out that we are not the only form of life in the universe, that there is life out there. This principle of modesty is very important to adapt because it has implications. It says, you know, if life is common, we should just go and search for it. Let's explore the sky and find evidence for it.
Well, doctor, we should probably set the stage by asking what criteria need to be met.
Right. So, first of all, I should mention that our imagination is not as rich as nature's, and so we can imagine life as we know it, as we find it on Earth, meaning that we're talking about the chemistry in liquid water that we are familiar with that leads to life. So we need liquid water to have life as we know it. And to have liquid water, you need to be at the right distance from a star that will keep the planet warm. In addition, you need an atmosphere to that planet, because if you just take water ice in vacuum and warm it up, it turns directly into gas.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't go into liquid phase. To have a liquid phase, you need an external pressure, some medium around it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what the atmosphere provides on Earth. So to get liquid water, you need an atmosphere. And the planet needs to be massive enough to retain the atmosphere, not to lose it. Because the atmosphere is exposed to illumination from the star and can get evaporated. So you need a planet roughly the size of the Earth that is massive enough. We have a warning sign nearby, Mars. Mars is, you know, a tenth of the mass of the Earth, so it lost its atmosphere. And, I mean, we don't see clear evidence for life on it. There might have been life on Mars. So that's a warning sign that a planet that is not massive enough can lose its atmosphere.
But, doctor, there's ample evidence that there are a number of planets that meet those conditions, right?
That's right. So even when you restrict attention just to planets roughly the size of the Earth at the right distance from their host star, you're still left with about a quarter of all the stars that have such planets. That means that there are billions of habitable planets in the Milky Way galaxy alone. And then there are billions of galaxies like the Milky Way in the universe. So there are plenty of opportunities for life to emerge.
Billions of galaxies like the Milky Way? Is that what you just said?
Yes. Within the observable universe, there are many billions of galaxies like the Milky Way. We are not special in that regard. The Milky Way is sort of a typical galaxy in the universe right now. I should also mention that stars like the Sun are not the most typical stars. The most abundant stars are lower mass, dwarf stars, and they live much longer than the Sun. They live for 1,000 times longer than the Sun. And you may ask, why is it that we live next to a star that is not the most common star? At the present time, if you have these dwarf stars that live much longer, perhaps we are more likely, life is more likely to exist around the dwarf star in the distant future. And I actually did a calculation that indicated that this would be the case. It would be much more likely to live next to a dwarf star in the future, unless life is somehow suppressed there. The environment might be more hostile to life near a dwarf star because it flares a lot. Now, the nearest star to the sun is actually a dwarf star. It's called Proxima Centauri. Mm-hmm. And last year, there was a planet discovered at the right distance from that star that could, in principle, have liquid water on its surface. It's called Proxima B. And this is the nearest star to us. And this actually motivated us to consider the possibility of visiting that planet. There is a project called Starshot, where we are planning to develop the technology necessary to launch a spacecraft that would reach Proxima Centauri within our lifetime, within our generation. I mean, Proxima Centauri is about 4 light years away. Mm-hmm. So it takes light 4 years to reach us. And in order for a spacecraft to get to Proxima within our lifetime, within, let's say, 20 years, it needs to move at the fifth of the speed of light. And an interesting question is, how can you launch a spacecraft that moves so fast? The way to do it is with a laser beam that pushes on a sail. So the idea is that you have a sail, just like the sail of a sailboat, and instead of it being pushed by the wind, it's being pushed by light, by a laser beam that is focused on the sail and pushes it to a fifth of the speed of light. So this is a project called Starshot, and I'm chairing the committee that is designing the project. Right now, we have $100 million funding for the next 5 years to demonstrate the feasibility of this technology.
So, Doctor, it's likely that within our lifetime, we will learn a great deal more, is what it sounds like.
Yes, and that makes it very exciting. We are at a tipping point where we now have the technology that allows us to study the sky with exquisite sensitivity. And by the way, the Keck Observatory here in Hawaii was instrumental in pioneering many of the discoveries of those distant planets out there. And so, in a way, Hawaiians should be very proud of this state that we are at, a state of knowledge that was promoted, actually, a lot on Mauna Kea with the Keck Observatory.
Dr. Abraham Loeb is a Frank B. Baird Jr. Professor of Science and Chair of the Astronomy Department at Harvard University.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors, locations, Noheia Gallery, and Straub Medical Center.
The approach of the weekend means it's time to look at activities going on throughout the state, and our Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama keeps an eye on these for us, looking at events going on under the radar. And we've got something going on in Hawaii Island that's a window into Japanese culture, Derek.
Yes, it's a traditional Japanese celebration called Tanabata, mm-hmm. or the Star Festival. I should have known what this meant, but because I'm part Japanese, but I did not. I have
Nobody's
to admit.
Perfect there.
Okay. The festival features children's games, food, and entertainment. You can dress up in a kimono and have a photo taken for a small fee, or take part in tanzaku, where you write your wishes on pieces of paper and hang them up on bamboo. And you can eat somen, nagashi. I know this part, cold noodles, perfect for summertime. This is from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Hawaii Japanese Center in Hilo.
And there's another project going on at the Hawaii State Art Museum, a make and take project.
That's right. Tomorrow you can learn how to make shadow puppets with puppeteer and teacher Bonnie Kim. I drop in at any time between 11 a.m. and 3 p.m. at the Hawaii State Art Museum. Allow at least 30 minutes to complete a project. All ages are welcome and materials are provided. For this.
And if you've ever seen a shadow puppet show, it really is something to see. Isn't it?
Yes, I shall make an mark that on my calendar.
Indeed. And there's a cultural festival in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park tomorrow.
Yeah, it's called the 37th Annual Hawaiian Cultural Festival and Bio Blitz. There will be hula, music, arts and crafts, and other cultural practices. This year's festival, as I said, will include a bio blitz, a chance to join scientists and cultural practitioners and discover the biodiversity in the park. It's from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. in Hawaii Volcanoes National Park on the Big Island.
And I guess that's what a bio blitz is, huh? A chance to discover the biodiversity in the park?
Mm-hmm, yes.
It's a new
one
on me. They
shall find this out. It's all under the radar to me.
Well, we learn something new every day.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
Sure.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. You can always find out more about those events at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
And that's going to bring us up to the top of the hour. And that's going to bring us also to the end of this week. Now, next week, thousands of websites will be showing their support for saving net neutrality from the FCC plan to slash the Title II legal framework. We're going to talk about some of the local efforts for the Day of Action.
And we'll look at the multicultural influences behind the music of Jamarek.
You can talk back about anything you hear on the show on our talkback line. Leave your comments at 808-792-8217. Email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, or you can post comments on Facebook or on Twitter.
If you want to know more about the music you hear on the show, you can find a playlist on our page at hawaiipublicradio.org, where you can also listen back to today's show. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kosovich.
Jillian Song produces the program, and Ryan Finnerty and Amber Kahn are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kosovich. We'll see you Monday when we pick up the conversation.